I'm a little noise. I'm a little amazed by the fact that the repeater's a little bit noisier tonight. Could be because of the rain. K2 Romeo India Whiskey here. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limelock. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education. A little bit of humor sneaks in. And the subjects that are appropriate for the TechNet are anything of interest to radio amateurs. So, of course, it includes your usual questions on the subjects of favorite transmitters, receivers, feed lines, antennas, modes of propagation, and the various ways of getting the most amount of fun out of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio, 2-meter FM repeater radio, which you're listening to. It's just one of the 26 kinds. And if you get bored with this one, there's 25 others to try. And we discuss many of those other 25 from time to time. A person signs into the TechNet by giving me and Mel your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. And the yes means that you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in if you do not. 1982 to now, almost 25 years. By now, we've come to the conclusion there are probably people out there, and it doesn't have to be proven to us. I expected the TechNet to last a couple of years. We'd answer everyone's questions and go away. 25 years later, we're still here. Okay, a typical sign-in would be K2KEY. No, him at this time.
K2EO, Rich, and yes. K2CGW.
KBY.
Blue, W2BIE. Good evening, Dick. No.
W2, Tango, 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 Gordon. No. Good evening, Dick.
W2N. Good evening, Dick. What's coming?
And this is K2KEY, good evening to all.
K2MB with a big yes. Good evening, Dick. How you doing?
KC2MDP, Steve, and no questions tonight, Dick.
Barry, you could use a little bit more audio, but you sound good. That was a big yes for Barry. Had to get people to sign in. Let's see, I did get with a few doubles, Rich Yo, TGW, OQD Bob, let's see, a number of people who said no, and N2MB. Of the yeses, did I miss anyone?
K2MLB.
K2M, Paul, comment.
Yeah, I got you, Paul, and with the comment, I should have mentioned that. And MLB, we got you. Okay, Rich first, go right ahead, Beth. What's new in Whitestone, Queens?
Okay, Dick, good evening, and to we, Dick, my question is on RF power amplifiers, in particular that 228877 amp that I'm working on. I got the second tube, put it in, running into a few problems, 60, 80, 40, 20, on 15 meters and especially on 10 meters, Dick, the tank coil, the 10-meter tank coil gets very, very hot, hot enough to melt solder. And I'm not running excessive power, it's backing it down, and also I'm getting a lot of arcing. I'm wondering if that could be parasitic oscillation. I'm not trying to put a parasitic capacitor on the one tube. I'm wondering with two tubes if I not might need the parasitic suppression, can I take?
Yeah, and if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, 8877, I believe that is a external anode ceramic type tube. Is that true, Rich?
Yes, it is, Dick. And that's the thing, the tube is specced with 250 megs, so it's quite possible there could be some VHF parasitics in there.
Say 3CX is 1500, Dick.
Yep, I'm familiar with that tube. And for that to go into parametric oscillation, and certainly got enough that would take a good spectrum analyzer. And now, how are you going to find somebody with a good spectrum analyzer? So, of all the possible things that are creating excess heating of your loading coil at the tank, your final tank circuit, which is probably a PI network, and you probably have also noticed that your loading capacitor is now set to a, and by the way, think about this, much lower number than before. In other words, if increasing the number increases the capacitance, now, when you set the C2 capacitor, the right-hand capacitor on most amplifiers, when you set it to the minimum number, 0 to 10, it normally has the capacitor plate maximum closed, because that's the method of getting minimum loading. And as you turn that dial more clockwise from 0 calls, heavier and heavier loading. It may seem like opposite of common sense. You may have noticed that if everything else is correct, control I should say, now must be turned more clockwise than before. That's if it is set up in such a way that more clockwise is less capacitance. If they set it up backwards from that, they'll have to figure out what I'm talking about. So, with two tubes in parallel, your source impedance of your RF energy is a much lower number. That loading control must be set to a lower capacitance. And it also means that the total amount of circulating current in the tank circuit has doubled. Let me think about that. Yeah, I think it's approximately true. So twice the amount of current. Now, should twice the amount of current create such an excessive amount of heating, the real resistance of your coil and what is, whether or not there's parasitics. To my knowledge, parasitic oscillations create all kinds of grief when it comes to television interference and maybe light at the tube. But can a parametric oscillation create excess heating? I think the answer is no, because that tank circuit has got such an extremely high loaded Q. In other words, it is a resonator. When you're tuned to 15 meters, that pair of capacitors and that inductor are so narrowly tuned to the 21 megacycle region, does oscillation create excess heating of the coil? I think the answer is no. You may get some other opinions from other people. Now, as I was starting to say, what creates heating of a coil? Total energy flowing through it, of course. If you had a really sturdy power amplifier, like you do with a pair of those tubes in parallel, and if you were setting the circuit for very light loading, so there's now more circulating current than normal, that would aggravate the situation. 77 is a tetrode, and as so, screen grid current is your first indication. It's a triode, always a tetrode, because screen grid current tells you right away whether or not you're heavy or light on the loading. The other thing that will create excess heating of the coil is if you're not making a very low resistance contact to it. I'm assuming the amplifier has a big rotary dial where you set the band you're on, 10, 15, 20, 40, those contacts and the wiring between those rotary contacts and the tap points in the coil, that'll be very sturdy wiring, very low resistance, and so on. When you say it is the coil itself that's getting hot, I presume you're differentiating that coil from the wiring going over to the switch and the switch contacts themselves. Is that true, Rich? Back to you for a quick break on that one.
I'm correcting, and there's a four-section coil. The 80 and 160 coil is fairly light duty, and as you go up, they use heavier and heavier coil. Now, that coil for 10, 15, and 20 is made out of, an ace and less than a quarter-inch copper tubing, and it's getting quite hot.
So, you're sure it is a contacts to it. In other words, you've got tap points on it going to the rotary switch. Are you telling me the wiring going to the rotary switch and the rotary switch itself, do you think it is cool by comparison to the coil? That's question number one. And the capacitors, your C1 tuning capacitor and your C2 loading capacitor, are they directly wired to the coil, or are they wired to the coil by way of the rotary band selecting switch? Back to you for that one, Rich.
I guess.
Okay, let's switch over to Mel. Mel, sounds to me like you've been there and done that. Let's switch to Mel on the subject, sir.
This is K2KY. No, not myself, but I have a friend that built a homebrew version of that amplifier, and he ran into the same difficulties. We just got upset putting in the 5-volt. Filament transformer we were discussing and things of that sort. And he finally tamed the amplifier down. He had a discussion about it. First of all, the coils from 4 coils, as he said, yes, he had 4 coils also.
He took the 10 meter and the 15 meter, 20 meter coils. What the heck? Oh, yes, he made them out of quarter inch copper coils, came through. You buy them pre-made. They were one-eighth copper tubing. No, one-eighth outside diameter tubing. So that must have been, what do they call that? I forgot what they call that. Let's see if it's one-eighth outside diameter. I forgot what they would play. He changed it over to a quarter-inch copper tubing, silver-plated copper tubing. Now, I'm going to ask Rich a few questions. If he's got the schematic, I'll tell you what the modifications he also made to the amplifier, Dick, over.
Hey, why don't you two go back and forth with your questions. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, do you have
a... I can pull it out, stand by.
Ask him how he's connecting to the coils. I have a feeling he's not connecting to the coils well enough.
Yeah, that's part of what I was a little concerned about also, Barry. Barry, if you get a chance, you ought to turn up the audio on that. And I'm curious as to whether or not the tuning and loading capacitor is correctly connected to the coil, or are they somehow connected by way of the rotary band selecting switch. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I'm going to ask him a number of questions because that's why I'm going to go over to each one of the corrections that he had on that amplifier on the homebrew version because that's what they built it from. There was a published homebrew version, a pair of 8877. Well, it actually started out with the 3PX series, you know, the imported tube stick. The original one with the IMAX, the 3PX 1500A7. That's the original amplifier.
DPC recognizes it. By the way, I think most amateurs pronounce it Svetlana, S-V-E-T-L-A-N-A, phonetically, Svetlana, a good Russian tube company. DPZ, go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, I'm familiar with the 1500 that Rich is working on. The coil in that thing on 10 to 15 meters is not that heavy. And with two tubes and a high circulating current, that's why we have a heating problem. You really have to change that coil out for those bands. It's made an intermittent pulse operation side band, and for the amount of current that he's drawing key down, it's going to get warm the way it is.
So I'm hearing a common denominator here. Mel, Hal, and others know that this particular amplifier circuit with a pair of tubes tends to run hot on that coil unless you beef up that coil. And I'm trying to think now whether or not the circulating current is going to be higher. And I think the answer is yes. With the two tubes, the circulating current is going to be higher, number. Your tuning capacitor is going to be set to a slightly higher number equivalent. I say equivalent because you're also adding extra capacitor as far as the Pi network. Hold on a second. As far as the Pi network is concerned, the total input capacitance is each of the plates plus the C1 capacitor. That combination of capacitors is going to be set higher when you've got two tubes versus one. So for a bunch of reasons you got there, and since heating is a function of current squared, and you've just doubled it, most likely you've come very close to quadrupling the amount going to the next larger diameter copper tubing. Sounds like it's going to be required. That's what I'm hearing. Mel, you might have some further comments before you pass it back to Rich and go right ahead and do that. K2KEY, take over, sir.
This is K2KEY. Of course, right away we're going to say that height contact, of course, is a very important factor in the design of the amplifier. I would assume everything is tightly, you know, connected to one another. That I would assume. And you're right, exactly. But in the original circuit, they had feedback. I guess a number of people built them had similar problems and all. And he was on the air when he got on, he literally says he saw this heat come out of it, and nothing was burning. That's how hot it got. I would say then you shut it down. Rich is back.
By the way, I've got another quick question for Rich. Rich said a magic word. He KU's occasional arc over. In other words, is the arc over taking place in the capacitors or inside the tube itself? If it's taking place inside the tube itself, one of the tubes is not thoroughly debonicled and thoroughly degaussed, or not the gettering function, in other words, there's some spare particles floating around inside the tube, air particles that haven't been collected yet because of a normal wake-up procedure, or I have often seen it that that loading capacitor on the output hasn't been set for much higher loading of two tubes versus one tube. Unless you do that correctly, the total RF voltage on the input capacitor can easily double, and that's not supposed to happen. Therefore, the total amount of RF voltage the amplifier could see, if it was Class C service, would be a Class B or Class C service, could go to much higher numbers, and therefore the tube is much more subjected to arc over. But the capacitors before, when this thing is running correctly tuned and loaded, assuming those controls don't run out of range, with the two tubes, the total voltage swing on the input capacitor should be absolutely no higher than it was before. The total voltage swing on the output capacitor will be, let me think, 41% higher. The output voltage will be 41% higher. And so if the output capacitor is the one that's arcing over, that's somewhat anticipated, understandable. So we got a number of questions there, Rich, as you can tell. Wiring of those capacitors to the coil, but I'd like to know if you possibly, and maybe you don't know yet, but some further investigation, you'd like to know when you do get the arc over, what were you doing, and can you locate the arcing? When you look through the cave, so to speak, can you identify the location of the arc? Because depending on where it is, will give you some other very strong clues. Thanks, time to give Rich a chance to talk. M2EO, KQIW in the TechNet.
I did see a little arcing in one of the capacitors, but generally it was coming from the tube, one of the two tubes. I'm not sure which one. Being heavily loaded, I noticed in the process of tuning it up on 80, 40, 20, no problem. When you get to 15 and 10 meters, if you come up on the drive, it's a little touchy to tune up as you go up in frequency. In other words, you have to come up on the drive, otherwise you'll get an arc over in the tube. Only on the higher frequencies, Dick, back to that.
Okay, the fact that the amplifier is more persnickety in tuning characteristics, more narrow band at the higher band, that's all very understandable. Normal characteristic, something that we have to get used to. The fact that you saw arcing over in the capacitors, it would be very helpful to know, is it the input capacitor or the output capacitor, the loading capacitor that arced over? If it's the loading capacitor at all, and the way you're tuning and loading, just that you may have to go to a slightly sturdier capacitor there, or one of the things that I've done in the past is I made sheets of Teflon, and I put them between the air-spaced blades of the capacitor to stop the arc over. But even there, you got to be careful. You got to make sure you've got what's called virgin Teflon. If you use recycled Teflon, it has pinholes in it that you can't even see. They're microscopic, but you'll get arcing over, sometimes even increased with the Teflon sheets. So I had a 6-meter amplifier that used to arc over on its C1 capacitor, and with those sheets of Teflon, I was able to make that stop happening. The arcing over in the tube, though, is a little bit troublesome. And you should try to avoid that because it's doing damage each time it happens. Too lightly loading is the usual reason for that. And you're picking up because when you're low on drive and you adjust for maximum power output, that is a setting of the controls where if you are going to operate from there, it's great. When you then start sneaking up with higher drive from that point, you are now increasing the voltage swing on the plate of the tube, and the tube is more subject to arc over, unless you immediately go to more heavy loading. As you increase the drive, you must be going to a lower limiter. You almost have to do that first before you increase the drive, even though the power output will come down at first. It seems opposite of common sense. But if at any regimen where you're light on loading, you're much more subject to arc over of tube and C1. If the loading is heavy enough, and you're only arcing C2, believe it or not, that's a good sign. It indicates you're going to have to do something with C2, but the fact that you're getting a 41% increase in the output voltage is a very good sign. I hope you're arcing in C2. If you're arcing in C1, it's a strong indication that your loading was too light. Those are some of my comments. Let's see what Mel's got to add to this. And I think Mel's got some specific questions K2KEY, now that you got the schematic in front of you. K2KEY, go right ahead, K2IW in the SIGNET.
Roger, this is K2KEY, you're 100% right, Dick. You got a heavy loaded, any of these amplifiers got to be heavy loaded. You cannot light, you know, it's got to be, they will arc. All right, now that C2 arcing was another question that I see here that you also mentioned to me. Let me ask you about C2 while we got that fresh in mind, Rich. What is the value of C2 in your rig, over?
Let me see,
there's
a
40.
Yeah. I'm going to go over the schematic here. The loading, I don't see the C19 is the plate tuning. And I don't see it all van metal. I have to study this.
Let me ask you, Richie, when you take the driver off, does the arc go away immediately?
Oh, your audio is very low. Yeah, I got it here now. 800 picofarad, 1.2 kV for C2. C1 is 190 picofarad at 4.5 kV.
Okay. It was a problem there. My friend had the original that design. It called for 1,000 PF at C2. But even with that, he had to put across the capacitor. He had to shunt it across C2, and his was at 1,000 PF. And still, he had to shunt it with 100 PF to calm it down, Rich, over.
Okay, well, that would indicate that the thing isn't closed up enough. I mean, as I loaded, I'm decreasing the capacity when it's loaded on C2.
Realize that, but that's what he said. He says he added that, and there was, I guess, at the time it meant something because he says it eliminated C2's problem. Trying to think, you'd say, yes, right. It should. Okay, well, that was one of the modifications. He had 1,000 PF and said 10 kV had, geez. And he said he added a 100 PF across it at 5 kV. All right, that's one of them. Now, let that go for the time. What do you've got coming off the plate? Because they had a modification that they have added. He came off the plate. He says he had to change the original network coming off the plate. He put three 150 ohm 2-watt carbon resistors in parallel and strap them together on each one of the tubes, Rich, over.
Okay, wait a minute, that sounds like a parasitic choke. They couple off the tube to C14 and 15 caps, and then they go through right to the plate choke, which is RFC3, just the part number. It doesn't say a Bill Henry's.
It says DPZ with comment. I got a quick question for you, Rich. You told us 190 picofarad for the input capacitor. You told us 80 picofarad for the output capacitor. Are you sure you don't have those reversed? I think under normal circumstances, the input capacitor is the small one, and the output capacitor is the big one in a Pi output tuning network. Thank you, Rich.
Okay, I don't know if you heard more of what I said wrong. The input's 190 picofarad, the output's 800.
Fantastic. That makes a lot more sense. Howard, you had
it should be about 12 in that tank circuit. If it's too high of a Q, it could tend to arc over also. I got to get out of here, gentlemen. Have a good evening. K6 DPZ clear.
At 15 meters, that's 18.9 ohms on the output capacitor reactants. 18.9 and 50. Gotta turn the dot calculator on first. Okay. 18.9 and 50 is gonna be an extremely low Q, like 3. So I don't think he's running too high a Q. I sure would love to know, is it the input capacitor, the 4.5 kilovolt rated capacitor, is that the one that's arcing over, or the output capacitor, 2 kilovolt? That would be very helpful. But I think we're almost positive on everything we're hearing so far, Rich. Sounds to me like on your 20, 15, and 10 meter coil, you're about to increase its diameter of copper. I'm hearing that loud and strong. Let's see what Mel's got to say on that one. And then, Mel made an experience in this one too. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I'm just going to tell you, I could say this guy went through quite a bit doing because he was in the broadcast industry and worked on some of the humongous transmitters and all, and so he more or less was able to dope it out with a number of people that were basically very involved in this type of business. Now, as I say, coming off the tube, the plate of the tube, it's on each one of them, he put, I got it marked here, 3 150-ohm, 2-watt carbon resistors in parallel. And that, let's see, yeah, that on each tube, he's got that. Now, on as far as the next step, the RF choke, he's got two, let's see, where is it? I got someplace here, yeah. The first RF choke he has in there is a 2-amp RF choke. He bypassed that to ground with a 0056 kV. He then put a second choke in series with it, 18 turns, half inch in diameter, and then bypassed that, the high, well, that goes to the high voltage. He bypassed that with another 0056 kV. He then, from that, the two parallel caps he used, let's see, yes, he's got two 1,000 PF caps at 10 kV in parallel. That goes to, of course, to C1. That is the modification up to that point. And then I could say, oh, yeah, he changed, the, I could say, the coil, quarter-inch copper tubing, silver-plated, and he says gave him a better Q. He was able to achieve a better Q in that circuit at that point, Dick. That's the modifications I've got that so far over.
Okay. I think we're slowly zeroing in on what changes you're going to have to make, Rich, and I can sort of see why the manufacturer doesn't normally do this, doesn't recommend it. And they probably have heard enough hard up as you are and as enthusiastic as you are to go through all this to make these changes to make it all work well. When you say the coil ran hot, I think you said it was hot enough to melt solder. That's a good enough clue to me. You probably smelled it as well as hot enough to run solder, to melt solder. And doing that heat is one thing. Having that amount of heating, which would be drastically decreased if you were running normal single sideband mode, is something else. So for the time being, as long as you're not getting arc overs, you probably could operate it in the sideband mode, you know, intermittent commercial amateur service. Here I go. Let's see. Continuous commercial service or intermittent amateur service, I think you would possibly get away with it, but I'm pretty sure you're going to want to increase the size of the coil, you know that. And once you find out which of the capacitors is arcing over, sounds like you're going to have to make a modification there. As long as the amplifier is running Class A or Class AB or Class B, Class A or AB, where most of the time current is flowing, and assuming you're running less than a 3,000-volt power supply, a input capacitor rated for 4,500 should be enough. If you were running Class C, it might not be enough, because many a Class C amplifier, the RF voltage on the plate swings twice as high, choke. So Class A doesn't do that. Or does it? Or does it? Yes, yes, yes. And we got to divide that by square root of 2 because it's the RMS problem. Square root of 2 divided into 4,500 tells me that anything more than 3,000 volts of D-plus on that amplifier is going to create a potential arc over of that first capacitor, the no-rich, under load. N2EO, KQLIW.
Okay, Dick, it's 4,000 volts no load. Under load, it drops to about 3,400 volts.
Wow. Okay. As I see it, that capacitor of only 4,500 volts being overstressed. And because people don't use the amplifier in the mode where the plate swings the maximum voltage, maybe they get away with it. but that's a marginal capacitor. I'm going to guess that when you do a little further investigation, we're going to give you a homework assignment here to try to find out where the arcing is coming from, when it's not inside the tube, when it really is a capacitor. My vote is the C1 capacitor is the most likely culprit, the 190 picofarad, 4,500 volt job, in which case you've got two choices. Either to clean it up to make sure there's absolutely no sharp little points and no dust or anything else in there. I mean, an air-type transmitting capacitor will arc over if there's great big balls of dust inside, if there's even tiny little specks of dust, if there's sharp little points and whatever. With a good magnifying glass or microscope, you want to give it a real thorough inspection to make sure that there's no corona-inducing points on that capacitor. And it's time for you to order some compos we got here tonight, Rich. Let me send it back to you for a final. I think you got more than enough work to keep you busy until we hear from you again. And 2EO,
take a shot on this coils.
Okay, Mel, we'll go to you right after Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I don't have anything else. Let's turn it over to Mel. Original coils, 11-turn coil. Give me some specs, and then we'll go on to
Yeah, you want to make some little notes. The coil, for 10 and 12 meters, he wound it, turned, plated copper, 2 inches in diameter, 2 inches long. That's for the 10 and 12 meters. C1, he measured it at that time, was 26 PF, and C2 is 112 PF. 15 meters, the coil, the 15 through the 40 meter coil is 12 turns, quarter inch silver plated copper tubing, 3.5 inch outside diameter, 4 inches long, and then he's got the taps marked off, but the For C1 on 15 meters is 37 PF, C2 164 PF. He worked out a whole chart of what will be correct for the Q and everything. You know, I have a whole detailed chart he worked out here. So anyhow, that'll give you some idea where you stand right now, Rich. Over.
Okay, Mel, very good. I thank you for the information. I guess my next step is to go to C1. I might consider a vacuum variable. Back to you to KQRIW Tech Farmark and 2EO.
Yeah, I wouldn't jump to the vacuum variable immediately, Rich, because that could be an extremely expensive part unless you happen to find one on the surplus market. On top of that, I wouldn't bail out on your cleaning job. For all we know, it's been sitting in that amplifier for a number of years, collecting dust and so on, and below the power it used to run, it was pretty happy to do that. Now you're pushing it to the limit, and therefore you want it to be super clean. And so opening up, unmeshing its plates and looking at them with a good bright light and a good magnifying glass, and once you're sure it's good and clean and there's no sharp points and no dust balls or anything like that, nothing sticking out of either the rotor plates or the starter plates, either one having a sharp point will initiate an arc on you. You don't want that. And the next level of improvement, I've done it, is to take virgin Teflon at the right thickness to make sure it'll squeeze in between those plates and make yourself up some spacers that go between the plates. So when the plates are meshed, they're not the rotor and starter are not just looking at each other through air, they're looking at each other through some air, through a sheet of Teflon, then some air. And in my case, it stopped all the arcing and gave me a good high Q capacitor that worked very nicely for years beyond that, at the half kilowatt level on 6 meters kind of things, and where you are on 10, 15, and 20. So I wouldn't bail out on your C1 capacitor yet. You've got a number of options as I see it before you go to the big expense. A few of them laying around. Now you've got all kinds of stuff, in which case, obviously, other ways to go. Leslie, we've been keeping you waiting for a while. Sorry about that. K2TGW. Are you still there, sir? Go right ahead with your question. K2IIW on the deck net.
Still here, just watching the water recede back into the bay. Does it make me unhappy not to have waterfront property? At the last Limark meeting, we had a blind auction, which I won a few things, one of which is a Tempo FMH-42. This is rather large size ham for 440. Problem is, can't figure out what frequency it's running at, and I have a strong feeling it's crystal control and only the first channel is a working channel. I know it emits power, I'm just having a problem trying to figure out where, since I don't have any kind of frequency count.
The W2CDL at the next tune-up clinic, where he's got either an ISR or a real spectrum analyzer. ISR has got a spectrum analyzer built into it, where it'll act like a dummy load and display on the screen exactly what power at what frequency is coming out with what kind of modulation. I think that's your easiest way of going. If we don't know if some on a tempo FMH-42 could very well be a commercial rig, or it could be ham radio. But it could be 440, 450, 460 megacycle type stuff. The actual crystal number that's in there might give you a strong clue if you knew how it does its crystal oscillator slash multiplier slash mixing scheme. Maybe the first dial-up is 10.7 megs or 21.4, and maybe it always uses high-side mixing. And once you get some basic information like that, pass it over to the net and see if anyone has any experience with a tempo model Fox Mike Hotel 42 440 megacycle ham. If so, speak up right now. A little bit afraid of that. It may be a somewhat rare rig, and that's why it ended up in a blind. But you and Andy, the W2CDL, to get together, and by way of his instrumentation, you'll eventually find out what it is. Also, if the Tempo company still exists, it may be worth a try to go to their website or give them a call on the phone and find out what they know. How about you, Les?
Last one sounds great, but that one, but it would cost about $16. If I bought three rigs for $8, I don't think that makes any sense. Maybe I'll just put it up for the next blind auction. But I would like to know more about it. I just got to really have to find someone who has had one of these or knows where I can find some inexpensive instructions thereof. If not, I will find Andy and see if we can find out what frequency is at. It says frequency range 400 to 512 megahertz. Low power of 1 watt, high power of 1.5 watts. That's about it. But it's distributed by Henry Radio, so you know all that is all passe, Rich.
Yes, Mr.
Frankus?
I'd be careful with your assessment of $16 would trap your list. Let me give you an example. Over the years, I've given lots of people advice about going and getting from 3/4 inch 70 ohm hardline, and you can get tremendous amounts of it for free. It's very low in loss, and I've got a few thousand feet of it in use on my property, and another thousand feet of it sitting on a reel, on various reels. When there's 200 foot left on the end of the reel, they bring it back to the stockyard just in case they're going to need a short piece someday, but they don't start another run down the block because they don't like putting in splices because the splices are unreliable. Okay. I gave that advice to a lot for direct burial for 20 years and so on. Really rugged stuff, low res, and you can't beat it. And so a buddy of mine ran into a stockyard which had tremendous amounts of the stuff, but they wanted to charge him $15 nuisance fee to give him a few reels of the stuff. They're probably going to give him 500 feet of it, and they wanted $15 for a nuisance fee who got it for free. I'm not going to pay $15. Well, I heard that story from him, and I said, you go to the Andrew catalog and you find a cable that has the same insertion loss. It's going to cost you $3 or $4 per foot. That man was offering you 500 feet of it. He was giving you $1,800 worth of cable, and you were unwilling to give him $15. I recommend you go back to him, hat in hand, kiss his ring, ask the extra nuisance, and get the cable. You see what's going on here? He had heard that somebody got it for free, and he wanted it for free, too. He knew the price of everything, but the value of not that particular cable. So if this radio has any significant value, if you think you could really use it, it's not just a great big clunker, then your and my spend $16 to know everything you want to know about it is worth considering. That's your choice. Obviously, Andy is the best first one. And so let me pass it back to you for any final comment there, Les. And sorry if I insulted you, T2LIW in the technet.
No insult. It was intended and none was taken. It's a big conqueror. It would be bad if I want to have a fight with somebody because it's heavy. No, it's not that important. It's just mostly curiosity and just to get it to work. If it became easy. I got it to work, I just don't know where it's working. All right, we'll talk to Andy and see if we can find out what frequency is at. All right, thanks anyway. This is K2TGW, and I'll be clear.
Okay, the next guy with the, I think the other people who lined in, signed in before him, all had no question, they were just signing in. So, Barry, eat that microphone, shout into it, give us some real audio, and proceed with your question, sir. And to Moonbound, K2RW in the TechMask.
Okay, I'm on a different mic. Maybe that's better. I got the audio turned up all the way on the radio, by the way. I can't go any higher. I could use one of these handy-dandy power mics. That would probably do it. Yeah, a simple question. The gold thing for 75 meters. Now, I've got these antennas that are going to be about 95 feet apart, have a piece of coax to insert, well, this is the first question. The wires that come from the antennas, can they be any length as long as they're the same length, or should they be quarter wave or something like that? All these people are telling me it should be quarter wave, but something in my mind tells me it makes absolutely no difference, and these people are making a mistake. The question is, how many degrees of phase angle am I supposed to put this phasing line, you know, this little short piece of coax? Is it supposed to be a quarter of a wave, a half wave, you know, how many degrees of phase am I trying to change this thing to make it into, I guess it's a director, maybe it's a reflector, I don't know. And when I do that, which way is this antenna going to fire? In other words, if I put this, I proceed with the quarter of a wave, you'll correct me in a moment, and is RF going to be in the direction of antenna A, or is it going to be in the other direction? K2RW and 2MB.
Okay. When it comes to feeding two independent emitting elements, that's what we're talking about here. You have two vertical dipole-like things, even though they're sort of... but when you're feeding two independent elements, the exact length that goes from the common point, your power divider, to them, does not matter. In other words, if both of them are a quarter wave long, both of them are half a wave long, if you want to feed them in phase, there is no magic length as far as phase is concerned. There is a magic length when it comes to impedance match. If the antenna itself happened to be a 72 ohm antenna, and you've got a 72 ohm transmission line, like RG9, I think, wait a minute now, I'm wrong on that one. The RG8 equivalent, that 70 ohm, I've forgotten the model number of it on stuff, but you know what I mean. There is an antenna, then I am sure the individual lengths do not matter, as long as they're equal to each other, if you want them to be in phase. But if the antenna happens to be stable, it does matter. Quarter wavelength gives you impedance inversion. 70 ohms on the far end of a quarter wavelength of cable, an odd number of quarter wavelengths of cable, will give you an input impedance that's lower than 50. That will give you something like 35, 38, something like that. You can calculate it. So you get this impedance of impedances and an odd number of quarter wavelengths of cable. If there's an even number of quarter wavelengths of cable, like half wave, then the input impedance and the output impedance will be the same, regardless of what cable you use. That's a crazy one. I mean, if your antenna is 70 ohms and you used a point long electronically, input to that cable would look like 70 ohms if it's lossless. So does the length matter? I gave you a yes and a no. As far as phasing is concerned, it doesn't matter. As far as impedance matching is concerned, it will matter. However, where you've got an antenna tuner and where the exact impedance is not that important, you can tune for it, maybe we shouldn't worry about that one. But now, when it comes to phased array antennas, the magic ingredient, which is not common sense, fire in the direction of delay. That's opposite of common sense. In other words, the signal coming out of, if I get a three-element Yagi antenna, and I'm studying it, and I use my driven element as my phase reference, and I make some careful measurements of what's going on the director and what's going on the reflector, is lagging in phase compared to what's on the driven element, and the signal on the, that's director, director is lagging, the reflector is leading. And so why should it be like that?
if I give you a mental picture, it'll help remember which direction is lead and lag. You'll admit that a signal coming out of the driven element takes a certain length of time to get to the director. So the signal that arrives there is going to be delayed in time, that number of feet to get there. If the signal being emitted by the director at that instant happens to be co-phase, it will add to it and strengthen the process of emitting that signal in the forward direction. So you can sort of see that you want the signal to arrive somewhat co-phase, and because of a length, delay in time, because of the distance, you can see why the direction should be delayed. If I go the other direction, toward the reflector, I want the signal toward the reflector to be canceled. So to get from the driven element toward the reflector, in my very simplistic example, this is not a good Yagi, but I could make a Yagi on paper almost work between the driven element and the reflector, and the reflector is operating with a quarter wavelength of phase lag. My question reads, phase wavelength and time for the signal to get from the driven element to the reflector, it means the signal is lagging, but the signal being emitted by the reflector is leading, quarter and a quarter differ by half, one is positive and one is negative, and so you get a half wavelength of difference, you tend to get cancellation. That's exactly what you want the reflector to do. You want it to cancel.